So this part of the talk, I'll give some results concerning the character and stability of a class of spin-liquid states and some speculations concerning how they might be relevant to these interesting experiments in this complicated material. And the second thing I'm going to talk about is a topic in the theory of superconductivity, which is something rather new and, to my mind, unexpected, which is how one can have a superconducting state, not necessarily strongly correlated, just a superconducting state, but instead of having the Fermi surface entirely gapped or having gap nodes as we're used to, this is a superconducting state that still has a Fermi surface left. A Fermi surface not of electron-like quasiparticles, but of Bogoliubov quasiparticles. Okay? So those are the two topics. So let me start talking about spin liquids. We've already had a talk on this subject. I think I can claim to have been frustrated by the search for spin liquids longer than anybody here. This is an idea that's been around for a long time, but the serious search for spin liquids really started with the advent of high-temperature superconductivity, and the search has been long and frustrating. Early on, there were Ansatz wave functions for spin liquids. There were various arguments for the existence of spin liquids. There were some highly uncontrolled mean field theories of spin liquids. These were all very exciting, but then one wanted to go beyond them. Eventually, a major development was that various engineered Hamiltonians were constructed that could show to have exact spin liquid states. And in parallel with that, a considerable understanding of what sorts of field theories would encode the essential features of various putative spin liquid phases were constructed and analyzed, among other things, for stability. And so with these two things, as a theoretical construct, spin liquids had a right to exist. They're stable phases of matter of known character that should exist somewhere in the generalized Hamiltonians of materials. Very recently, a step toward closer to reality has occurred, which is that finally there is really convincing evidence of spin liquid phases in numerical experiments of models that weren't engineered explicitly to have exact spin liquid ground states. Whoops. But, okay, I've already said that. However, what's missing is unambiguously convincing evidence of spin liquids in a real-world experimentally accessible system. Now, this statement in itself is controversial. There are various intriguing, quote, candidate states, but none of them is established. Candidate materials means materials that somebody, probably the person who was doing the experiment on or the theorist who was in the office closest to them, considered to be evidence of spin liquids. And established, okay, established is really the complicated thing here. The problem is that the only way to establish that something is a spin liquid state, since there's not a measurement you can do that says this is a spin liquid, is to show that it couldn't possibly be anything else. And this is a very difficult undertaking Because what it requires is that you have to try very hard to think of all the clever and nasty and unexpected ways that something more conventional could be behaving in an unexpected way, so as to rule out whether the unconventional behavior one is seeing is really just some schmutz effect. Okay, so in my opinion, the most promising candidate to date is this material. Now, this is, of course, a very shortened abbreviation for this material. ET and DMIT mean big, complicated organic molecules. Okay, DMIT is some particular molecule. We won't worry what it is. We refer to this material as DMIT, but there are other salts of DMIT that are made. So this is called DMIT-131 because there's one of these and three of those and one of those. Okay, anyway, that's the name of some organic crystalline salt on which experiments have been done. And I consider it the most promising in the sense that I've not been able, this is a very personal definition of promising, is that I've not been able to think of even a far-fetched alternative explanation for the observations in this material. And so that leaves it as a good candidate to be a spin liquid. Okay, and so in particular, what's been seen is this is an insulator. They make very high quality crystals in the sense that they have very sharp Bragg peaks. There's an odd number of electrons per unit cell, but nonetheless it's an insulator, and there's been no detectable magnetic or other symmetry breaking electronic order in these systems. So that by itself is interesting. It's a mod insulator of some sort. But despite being insulating, in terms of its response in neutral sectors, it behaves like a metal. It has a constant magnetic susceptibility, like the Pauli susceptibility of a metal. It's got a constant C over T, where C is the specific heat at low temperatures. It's got a constant linear in temperature piece of its thermal conductivity. So it's a charge insulator, but a neutral metal. Here's some data. Here's NMR data on this material down to 20 millikelvin, and the point of this data is there's no evidence of any magnetic order. This is specific heat data, including the DMIT material and several other candidate spin liquid materials. And what you can see is that C over T extrapolates to a constant value at low temperature. Now, of course, I'm sort of asking you to ignore this upturn. That's always seen in specific heat data. That's a Schottky anomaly. That's a Schmutz effect. But of course, that stops us from really taking this data down to low temperature and the really defining feature is the limiting value at zero temperature. So there's already a caveat here that the data is what the data is. And here is the susceptibility at low temperatures measured in two different ways. This is measured by torque magnetometry. This is measured directly in a squid. They don't quite agree. That bothers me a little, but they do seem to approach a constant value at zero temperature. So on the face of it at least, the susceptibility behaves like a metal. The specific heat behaves like a metal. The high temperature susceptibility, you see a Curie-Weiss behavior corresponding to spin a half on a triangular lattice with a J on the order of 250 Kelvin. So when we're down at 20 millikelvin, the fact that no ordering has occurred down to this temperature is rather spectacular. So the data on the face of it is spectacular. I believe in truth in advertising. So let's just list some of the things you should bear in mind. There are all sorts of barriers to extrapolating the thermodynamic data to low temperatures. The NMR data is, despite the fact that these are very good crystals, and despite the fact that if you put these same crystals under pressure, which drives it into a metallic state, they have spectacularly narrow NMR lines, telling us that at the chemical level, these are in fact extremely good crystals. But in the insulating phase, the NMR lines are actually noticeably inhomogeneously broadened. And that warns us that what the measure of disorder is not completely transparent. Now, as I said, we should be thinking about alternative possible phases of matter. This is a very good crystal, and everybody tells me I shouldn't think about disorder, but after all, one candidate alternative state is an Anderson insulator, which is an insulator to charge transport, but which has a constant density of states at the Fermi surface, and therefore has a T-linear specific heat and a constant Pauli susceptibility. Now, in the presence of interactions, that becomes more complicated, but that's just, since we're not trying to make a definitive statement that this is the alternative, just this is to raise doubts, I'm going to stop at that. The other thing is that this system, there are a lot of phase transitions in these sorts of materials. It could be that we're seeing not the properties of some phase of matter, but some properties of the quantum critical regime of some transition between two different phases of matter, and maybe that folded in with the effects of weak disorder could produce all sorts of things. Okay, so, well, the things I've told you are true not only of the DMIT material, but of several other organic salts. The thing that really convinced me to take this seriously is that in this material, and only so far in this material, the thermal conductivity also behaves like that of a metal. So here's the low temperature thermal conductivity of DMIT. This is kappa over T versus T squared, and you can see that it extrapolates very obviously to a non-zero value. This means that some excitations which carry heat are delocalized and can transport the heat efficiently through the entire system. If you think about it, since this is an insulator with infinite resistivity, this represents an infinite violation of the Wiedemann-Franz law. It means the ratio of the charge transport to heat transport is zero. Okay, so that's a pretty serious thing, and that's something that at least on the face of it is not compatible with an Anderson insulator. The fact that the thermal Hall angle is almost zero is important and confusing, but it's going to take me into issues that I don't have time to discuss today. There's one other thing I wanted to measure about the experimental situation, which is that there may or may not be a finite temperature phase transition. The NMR shown here shows a very sharp kink in 1 over T1, or here 1 over T1T, at a temperature of around 1 Kelvin, which the NMR people have interpreted as the occurrence of a phase transition of some unknown sort at this temperature. Now, the thermal conductivity also shows a sharp feature at around this temperature. which is not interpreted as evidence of a phase transition. It's interpreted that the high temperature thermal conductivity is due to phonons, and then at this temperature, the phonon mean free path becomes limited by the size of the crystal or dislocations or something like that, and so that it's only below this temperature that one is seeing the electronic contribution to the thermal conductivity, and this peak is just a crossover. And an evidence of that is this is another DMIT material, 221, but which has no magnetism at all, and one can see that the high temperature part of the thermal conductivity at least resembles that of this. So I don't quite know what to tell you about this. Here's the thermal hole conductivity, the transverse thermal conductivity in a magnetic field. And you can see that something happens at a magnetic field of around 2 Tesla, which in energies corresponds to a couple of degrees. So that's maybe consistent with there being a phase transition at 1 Kelvin of some unknown sort. While we have the NMR up here, I'll notice that although everything else I've told you about looks like the properties of a metal, in a metal you would expect 1 over T1 to go linearly with T, whereas here they clearly see below 1 Kelvin that 1 over T1 goes like T squared. And I'm going to ignore that because I don't know what to say about that, and neither does anybody else. Okay, so let me do the following thing. Let me put aside all doubts about the interpretation of the experiment. Let's take it at face value. Let's take at face value that the specific heat is linear in temperature, that the susceptibility is a constant, probably that there's a Wilson ratio of on the order of 1, that the thermal conductivity is linear in T, that disorder will stipulate plays no fundamental role in the state, although of course it's going to play some role in making a mean free path for transport. And let's just see whether we have any candidate spin liquid state that has these properties. By the way, there is a sort of internal check of the idea that disorder is not very serious, despite what I told you about the NMR, which is that if I interpret the thermal conductivity by a sort of a usual Boltzmann transport-like expression of the specific heat times a typical velocity times a mean free path, and if we estimate the typical velocity to be some spin wave velocity of order J times a lattice constant, then we end up with a mean free path of about 0.5 micron, which certainly supports the notion that this is a very clean material. Okay, so the question is there a candidate spin liquid system which is either stable or marginally unstable, which is consistent with these putative facts? Okay. Because this is a place where people revel in exotic phases of matter, I just want to make a small digression on the Fermi liquid state of simple metals, which in my opinion is not only interesting because it's widely observed in vast numbers of materials, but also is probably the most exotic state of matter that anybody has ever thought of. And the Landau theory of this is something that we should be banging our chests about and boasting about what a great accomplishment it is.
It's based on T squared relativity experimentally, and that's not necessarily signature of Landau's
perturbation. I didn't ever mention T squared. T squared resistivity is a minor portion of my reasoning. What's extraordinary about a Fermi liquid, I will tell you. Firstly, it has a large, large number of low energy excitations in it, larger than any other conventional state of matter. It's got a linear and temperature specific heat at low temperatures. And yet, despite that, it's only marginally unstable. The only weak coupling instability is to superconductivity, which occurs, if at all, only at extraordinarily low temperatures, despite this large number of gapless excitations. It's a system that continues to exhibit dissipation even in the zero temperature quantum limit. So it's a system that has non-vanishing quantum dissipation. It's a system characterized by long-range entanglement. And it has emergent quantum behavior on all length scales. The most dramatic evidence, so here's, for example, strontium ruthenate, and here's quantum oscillations, thousands of quantum oscillations on magnetic field scales that can't possibly be understood on the basis of dimensional analysis, but reflect with exquisite detail the structure of the Fermi surface. This Fermi surface, in this case, can also be seen with great precision in ARPIS, and one can, in fact, construct the Fermi surface in three-dimensional K-space with just extraordinary accuracy. This isn't just a problem set from Ashcroft and Merman. This is part of physical reality. And I think that's just amazing. Okay. So, now, back to the subject at hand. So, let me discuss the theory of superconducting phases with stable Fermi surfaces. So, I started thinking about this some time ago with my student Erez Berg. We were actually, you know, as most things in physics, the thing that gets you the energy to really do something is anger. And everybody was telling us that my favorite forms of order in the cuprates were inconsistent with nodal quasiparticles. So we decided to study what happens if we have a D-wave superconductor and then we break other symmetries. What happens to the quasiparticle spectrum? So here's the low-energy quasiparticle Bogoliubov-Degen Hamiltonian for a D-wave superconductor. And now I'm going to add some perturbations that are supposed to represent various types of broken symmetries and see what that does to the quasiparticle spectrum. Okay, and so here the two generic types of interaction of extra interactions we could add. There's H prime, which is all the terms that we could add that preserve time reversal symmetry, and there's H double prime, which is all the perturbations we can add that break time reversal symmetry. What one can see is that if you add a small term that preserves time reversal symmetry, that can shift the position of the node, but it doesn't destroy the node. But if one adds perturbations that break time reversal symmetry, then new things are possible. So we analyzed in this way various different perturbations. We found that nodal quasiparticles persist in D-wave superconductors with weak coexisting nematic order, commensurate charge density wave order, that is to say stripe order, unless it happens to exactly span the wave vector from one node to the next. Spin density wave order, of course, breaks time reversal symmetry, but it preserves some combination of time reversal and translation symmetry, and for these purposes, that's as good as preserving time reversal symmetry. The density wave order, Niel order, all these orders can coexist, at least with, if weak, with nodal quasiparticles. But there were two particular types of coexisting order we recognized would have a significant effect on the nodal spectrum. One is ferromagnetism. So ferromagnetism is represented by one of the terms in H double prime, which gives a different energy to spin up and spin down quasiparticles. And this results in two Fermi pockets, one for spin up and one for spin down. Now, those pockets themselves are generically unstable to P-wave pairing of the nodal quasiparticles. It's only a marginal instability. You might not worry about it, but there is a marginal instability. That's because ferromagnetism breaks only time reversal symmetry. So we also considered a form of broken symmetry considered by Chandravarma, which consists of a ground state that has orbital loop order like this. And you can see about this state that this state, of course, breaks time reversal symmetry because it's got currents, and it breaks inversion symmetry as well. And so if you ask, what does this do to a D-wave superconductor? Oh, that's pretty hard to see. There are these ellipses here. This leaves two of the nodes unchanged, but gives you two Fermi pockets here and here. Okay? So that's because this breaks time reversal symmetry and inversion symmetry. It produces two pseudo Fermi pockets, and in fact, these are the most stable Fermi liquids you've ever seen because they have no Cooper instability. Since epsilon of k is not equal to epsilon of minus k, there's no Cramer's degeneracy anymore. There's no infinitesimal instability of this system to pairing whatsoever. All right. There is a second class of superconducting state that has a Fermi surface, which we can't get to by just perturbing a D-wave superconductor, but that's a pair density wave in its generalizations. And this has been thought about by quite a number of people, including Catherine Callan and John Berlinski. And so this is, imagine a superconducting state where the superconducting order parameter itself is spatially modulated, so that if we translate the system by half a wavelength of the superconducting order parameter, the superconducting order parameter changes sign, which means that the superconducting order parameter averaged over space is zero, although it's non-zero in most places. This is a superconducting state. It breaks gauge symmetry. It has the Higgs phenomenon. It has off-diagonal long-range order, just of a rather peculiar sort. And one can calculate the Bogoluf-Degen spectrum in the presence of such a state. Here is a characteristic calculation that was carried out by Baruch and Orgad. This is the structure of the Fermi surface for some stripe-like pair density wave. Here is a picture of what the spectral function looks like, so only certain segments of the Fermi surface light up. Sort of an interesting structure. We have to make sure that this is a stable state of matter, that is to say that it isn't unstable to generating some uniform superconducting order which would then gap the rest of the Fermi surface. This can be done at the Landau-Ginzburg level. One could imagine writing down a term in a Landau theory that coupled a usual superconducting order parameter to the pair density wave order parameter. Such a term is allowed by gauge invariance, but it's not allowed by translation symmetry. Since if I take this this system and translate it by half a period of the pair density wave, this changes sign. So that term is not allowed. There are biquadratic interactions, but those don't lead to an instability. There is a linear coupling between the pair density wave order parameter and a charge 4e superconducting order parameter, so that what one concludes is that whenever you have pair density wave order, you also have uniform charge 4e superconducting order. That is to say, order that corresponds to condensation not of pairs of electrons, but quartets of electrons. And now, by itself, that's not interesting. This is some subdominant order. I still have a BCS description of this state in terms of the pair density wave. But this is interesting if one imagines gently melting the pair density wave. So suppose you have a pair density wave. So here we have plus delta, and here we have minus delta, and here we have plus delta. Here we have minus delta. That's the pair density wave state. And now imagine we imagine melting this by, I don't know, proliferating, well, double dislocations. So these things are sloshing around. And now if I sit here at this point in space, sometimes I see field minus delta, and sometimes I see field plus delta. So it means that the average of psi dagger is going to be zero. But if we melt the pair density wave by this process, proliferation of double dislocations, we will leave behind this charge 4e superconductor. So this is actually, as far as I know, the first proposal for a mechanism for charge 4e superconductivity. At any rate, charge 4e quartetting, does not lead to an instability of the Fermi surface. And so either the pair density wave or the melted form of it will have a Fermi surface. The melted version would then break the U1 symmetry not down to Z2, but to Z4. So the conclusion is that if we have a condition where the Cramer's degeneracy is violated in the superconducting state, we can have a stable Fermi surface. If we have E of k equals to E of minus k, we may still have a Fermi surface, which is at most marginally unstable. Any of these states are superconducting states, so everything else you know about superconducting states applies to them. They have zero resistance. They gauge field fluctuations are suppressed. Fluxoid excitations exist. The Higgs mechanism applies. And so on and so forth. Oh, the charge 4e superconductor would have half quantum vortices. Okay, good. So now I've finished the second talk. Now I'm going to return to the first talk. So now I'm talking about theoretical candidate spin liquid states. If we want to compare candidate theoretical spin liquid states with experiment, we'd like to know that the candidate spin liquid states at least exist stably in theory space. So it would be nice in each case to have a controlled or exact solution of an engineered model that we could show has the candidate spin liquid state. It would be good to have an effective field theory which permits a stability analysis. It would be nice to have some numerical evidence from a non-engineered model that such a state exists in a realistic Hamiltonian. And of course, best of all, there would be nice to have experiments to compare it to. Okay, so let me talk about, okay, so again, this is a place where classification of states is a major occupation. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk about some states that have a particularly simple characterization. This is no attempt at a complete discussion of candidate spin liquid states. But one of the ideas that underlies quite a bit of the spin liquid literature is that maybe at some high energy scale in a Mott insulator, we should think about the electrons breaking up into neutral spinons and charged holons, and that these, because we now have a redundant description of the physics, that these are describable by a wildly fluctuating U1 gauge field. Now, of course, it's possible to do this formally, but that's sort of meaningless. The place where a leap occurs is that we imagine that somehow at low energy, this breakup of the system becomes physical and gives us a reasonable description of the low energy physics, in which maybe the holons form an insulating state, and then with luck, we're left with a theory at energies small compared to J that can be described by fermionic spinons coupled to an emergent U1 gauge field. So I'm not going to try to derive this. I don't believe there's any derivation of it. There are formal derivations of it that are a lie, and so either this works or it doesn't. I'll try to justify by the solutions that at least sometimes it works. And now let's ask what can be the fate of this low energy theory. So now the low energy theory looks like the physics of a spin on metal coupled to a fluctuating gauge field, but probably in general, the effective phi structure constant is of order 1, since there's no reason now for it to be anything other than that. And so this is itself a strongly interacting problem, and what its fate is something that we have to discuss further. So one thing that can happen, one of the most interesting things that people have been studying theoretically is that especially in two dimensions, we're going to be focusing on two dimensions. The coupling to the gauge field is highly relevant. And so one thing that could do is to carry you to some new non-Fermi liquid fixed point, which still has a Fermi surface, but in which the Fermi liquid excitations are destroyed. This is an extremely interesting state. I'm not completely convinced it exists, but even if it does, it has non-Fermi liquid power laws, and therefore it's not a viable candidate to explain the experiments in the DMIT material under the assumption that we should believe that the experimentalists have gotten the power laws right. All right, well, so another thing that this could do is to lead to some form of superconducting instability, some sort of pairing instability in the spin on metal. Now, if it does that, then the paired spinons condense, and thereby Higgs the gauge field fluctuation. So now I no longer have to worry about the gauge field fluctuations in the low energy physics. We have a fully gapped Z2 spin liquid of the sort we heard about earlier today. And this is a phase that actually we're very comfortable with now, theoretically. This phase exists in various solvable models, such as the dimer model on the triangular lattice. And the existence of this phase has recently been established, at least to my satisfaction, in natural models, such as the J1, J2 model on the square lattice. I couldn't resist putting down an old reference. I did some exact diagonalization work in 1989 on a whopping big 4x4 system from which we recklessly concluded that at J1 about a half J2, sorry, J2, yeah, J1 about a half J2, sorry, J2 about a half J1, there was a spin Z2 spin liquid, which I think now turns out to have been right. So sometimes one's lucky. Here's some of the data. But this state is fully gapped. It has no low energy excitations. So this is certainly, it's a wonderful state theoretically, but it's certainly not a candidate for what's being seen in DMIT. Okay. Well, it could lead to some spin-on analog of D-wave superconductivity with nodal quasiparticles. Again, the existence of such spin-liquid states has been established, for instance, in the Kataev model on the honeycomb lattice. But this has, like a D-wave superconductor, a density of states that vanishes in proportion to energy, and so again, is not a viable candidate for DMIT. Okay, so now suppose that we ended up with a superconducting state that was an analog of the Varma loop state coexisting with superconductivity. We've managed to construct an exactly solvable model that has such a state. It's called the gamma matrix model. It's, well, so complicated, I'm not going to even write it down. The good news is that it has all local interactions. And the other piece of good news is that it has a ground state that that has gapped visons, spontaneously breaks time reversal symmetry, and has a spin on Fermi surface, which is stable. There is nothing other good to say about it. This phase is, in principle, absolutely stable to all small perturbations. On the other hand, since it breaks time reversal symmetry, it must undergo a finite temperature phase transition. So for this state to be a viable candidate, there must be a finite temperature phase transition at which time reversal symmetry is broken. So, okay, well, most people say there isn't a phase transition, but some people say there is, so maybe this is still a viable candidate for DMIT. Other than the fact that it requires a phase transition, it's consistent with everything we know. It should be possible to directly look for evidence of time reversal symmetry breaking and thus either confirm or falsify this conjecture. We could also have spin-on analogs of the pair density wave state. This was actually proposed some time ago by Sun-Suk Lee and his collaborators under the name of Amperian pairing. It's just the spin-on analog of the pair density wave. I think we were all working on these things more or less in parallel without realizing that we were working on the same problem. And this phase has a spin on Fermi surface and is only marginally unstable, but it has spontaneously broken spatial symmetry. Usually it has spontaneously broken translation symmetry, which must mean it would have a finite temperature phase transition. And I think, although I can't promise you, that were there spontaneously broken translation symmetry, that would have been detected. So I think this is probably not a viable candidate, but that's with reservations. And finally, we could have a Z4 version of a spin liquid, where condensation of quartets of spinons produce a Anderson-Higgs gapping of the gauge field fluctuations, leaving us with a state with no broken symmetries, no need of a finite temperature phase transition, and a marginally stable Fermi surface. Okay, so those are my candidate spin liquid states. Let me just recap. There are a couple other things I might say, but I think I'll skip them in the interest of time. Okay, so let me just remind you what it is I'm trying to explain. We have this DMIT 131 material. It's an insulator with one electron per unit cell. There's no magnetic ordering to the lowest temperature. The specific heat approaches a metallic value at low temperatures. The Wilson ratio of the susceptibility to the specific heat is of order one. The thermal conductivity remains finite at zero temperature. There is a peak in various things at around 1 Kelvin, which could signify a rounded phase transition, but might not. And the role of disorder isn't completely understood. Otherwise, this is really an excellent candidate for a spin liquid with not only a Fermi surface, but with a Fermi surface that obeys Fermi liquid theory. And let me end there. Okay, good. Thanks. That had some references.
So for the material, you mentioned that they show a finite thermal Hall effect for the triangular material.
The thermal Hall effect is zero.
Okay.
Or zero within experimental error.
I see. So then.
I believe there are several members of this family, right, which are organic triangular lattice systems, some of which are slightly distorted. A little bit unfair to ask you to go beyond and describe the experimental family, but can you put DMIT into the context of these other materials? How diverse are their phenomena?
To a limited extent, I can. So, first place, the party line somehow is that what's really important is how close one is to a perfect triangular lattice, and that it's this spin liquid behavior is very sensitive to the amount of distortion of the spin of the triangular lattice. The members of the family with slightly more distortion end up in some magnetically ordered insulating state. There are people also who theoretically claim to understand that statement. I'm not one of them. I don't particularly see why that should be the most sensitive parameter. I mean, we know that the triangular lattice by itself is nowhere nearly frustrated enough to support a spin liquid. So the frustration is presumably due to the fact that this is a Mott insulator that's very close to the Mott transition. So there are very, very complicated long-range interactions that are frustrating each other. And why those should be very sensitively dependent on how perfect the triangular lattice is completely escapes me. So the other thing I have to say about this is the following. So so once we establish in theory that spin liquids have a right to exist, then you might want to ask yourself, why aren't they all over the place? You know, once we establish that they're antiferromagnets, we find lots of antiferromagnets. Once we know about superconductors, we find lots of superconductors. Why has it been so hard to find spin liquids? All right, well, there's the super optimistic answer, which is that it's because they're hard to exist and they exist all over the place, you just don't know about it. But I think that our experience with numerical experiments suggests a different answer, which is that yes, they're phases, and so they have some finite measure, but nature really likes to break symmetries and order. And so in some 10-dimensional parameter space of Hamiltonians, you have to find, you have to tune each of the parameters within, say, a tenth of their natural value, which means that one in 10 to the 10th materials happen to fall in that sweet spot. It's still a finite measure, but really small. And then the answer is, I don't know, you just have to make lots of materials and then hope by luck you're going to land in the right place. I'm afraid that's my intuition as to what the real answer is.
We looked at one of these ET materials optically, and it's not clear that it's a regular insulator. It has a conductivity that starts at an extremely low value and rises linearly. Linearly with frequency, which is sort of unusual. It's not seen often. And so the question is it possible that it has some nodes or a pseudo gap or something and not be an insulator, this particular material you're talking about?
So it's an insulator in the sense that the resistivity, the DC resistivity, is diverging rapidly as you lower the temperature. Okay, so it's an insulator, there's no question about it. But it's not an insulator with a hard gap. It's not like silicon. It's an insulator with lots of low energy excitations. Now, of course, we already know there are lots of low energy excitations. There's, in fact, a metallic amount of low energy excitations. The issue is, how do those spin-ons couple to charge? And so at DC value, they're neutral. That's the construction. But they presumably do mix with electrons as you go up in frequency. And there have been a number of attempts to write down theories of what the optical conductivity is, none of which I understand, all of which produce power laws. I believe that for a pseudo-Fermi surface, they'll even produce a linear in-frequency power law. But since I don't understand the theory, I'm not going to, I can direct you to references on this.
More questions?
So you seem to have ruled out a D-wave-like gap for the spin-ons as a reasonable model. But if I think about the cuprates and the D-wave order parameter there, a key thing to describe something like the low-temperature thermal conductivity is the introduction of disorder, which gives you the finite densities of states at low energies and gives rise to a universal conductivity. Does disorder, would that sort of maybe be able to recover some of the properties?
All right,
that you
so that's a good question. So so the thermal conductivity, can people see if I write here or do we need more lights? Yeah? So first place, the thermal conductivity in the weak disorder limit for a nodal system will go like V Fermi over V delta, as you know. So it's not universal. It depends on V Fermi over V delta. Now, similarly, the specific heat over T, if I disorder broaden the nodes, is also going to have a finite value. And there may be some logarithm. I can't remember. I think there's a logarithm of tau that comes into that, but be that as it may. So if we want to get, if we want to explain both the high value of C over T and the high value of kappa over T, right, well, we have presumably V Fermi is something like J times A. So we have two parameters, so we can do it. And then we can ask, what do we need in order to explain the observed values? And you need a ratio of V Fermi to V delta, which is something like 1,000. That is to say, these nodes have to be so close to being a Fermi surface that they might as well be a Fermi surface. And there are all sorts of other problems. If you assume such anisotropic nodes, there are other predictions. So, while I can't rule it out completely, I think nodal spin liquid seems rather unlikely. Now, flipping your question around, there is a question about whether the experiments on the cuprates can be used to rule out the presence of orbital loop order. Okay? Orbital loop order would suggest that there is an intrinsic finite density of states at zero energy in the pseudo-gap phase at zero temperature. Okay? That's a strong prediction. There is argument from the Florida group that there is a residual specific heat in the cleanest samples of YBCO that's about 2 millijoules per Kelvin squared per mole or whatever the units are, that's seen independent of the amount of disorder in the system. So Chandravarma thinks that that's actually positive evidence in favor of this. I think most other evidence is that the nodes are pretty sharply defined in the cuprates, and I think that's hard to reconcile with orbital loop order. But okay, this is something that needs to be analyzed seriously and quantitatively.
I have a question. So, do you think that there is something that makes this particular type of spin liquid, you know, spin liquid with spin on Fermi surface, more likely than, let's say, a gap spin liquid?
Yeah.
You know, this is
that's a really good question. So, look, I think if there were no experimental data and you asked anybody who looked at spin liquids, what do you think is the first spin liquid that people are going to find. What's the most likely one? It would be a fully gapped Z2 spin liquid without question. And indeed, I think that's the only one for which good numerical evidence in numerical experiments has been found. I mean, you know, we all understand that systems like to organize themselves to get rid of low energy degrees of freedom. They can lower their energy by doing something and driving some states down and some states up and opening a gap. I would have thought that the spin liquid with a pseudo-Fermi surface was the least likely, okay? So, all right, what can I say? It's the one for which, so far, there's the most promising experimental candidate. So much for expectations.
Okay, so let's thank Steve for a wonderful talk.